Society Wildlife Land Trust. Visit wildlifelandtrust.org.
You're listening to CFRC 101.9 FM.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's News Collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, and Ellie Sturton. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines. After receiving a tie vote at Planning Committee, a 40-room development at 92 Napier Road came before Council with no recommendation, leaving Council to debate the matter at their meeting on Tuesday, August 12th. The proposal, brought forward by Amber Peak Developments, calls for the construction of four 10-bedroom buildings at 92 Napier Road, a development that would mostly be marketed towards students. To make this possible, Amber Peak is seeking both an official plan amendment and a zoning bylaw amendment to rezone the site from general open space to urban residential space. The suggestion triggered a strong community response. Many residents spoke at last month's planning committee meeting, voicing opposition to the project. A petition opposing the development garnered 332 signatures. Opponents argued that allowing high-density student housing in the quiet, family-oriented neighborhood could lead to increased noise, heavier traffic, and contribute to existing residents relocating, many of whom work in local businesses, the nearby hospital, and educational institutions. Councillor Vincent Shinani, who sits on Planning Committee, described the meeting.
At Planning Committee, it was divisive in a way. For me, rezoning from open space to anything else, it would have to be a really good reason. It had to be a really good benefit to the community. And I don't think that this is it. Living where I live, you see like what happens with this type of housing, moving further and further west. It just drives everyone away, and then it becomes like families move away, there's schools nearby. It just totally changes the character of the neighborhood. And I think that moving forward, having spoken to a lot of the community members, there's a lot more support in density near the university versus moving further and further west.
For councillors like Shinani, who are opposed, the core concern was that the development would introduce student housing into one of the last streets in the area that is not student-focused. The proposal's potential rent, estimated at around $1,000 per bedroom, also heightened concerns. Councillor Connie Glenn summarized these fears before council.
So let's be honest about what we're turning this into, and we are putting this, we're making this into a student ghetto. It's one of the last pockets where there's a family, where there's family-oriented housing. People walk their kids to school. Neighbors know each other's names. It's a community built on long-term relationships. I'm certainly not anti-student, as everyone I think is aware, but it brings a different rhythm to the area. It's late night turnover, noise complaints, short-term occupancy. It's a dynamic that's already saturating so much of the district. And so if we want families to live downtown, work downtown, then we need to make sure that we're providing space for them. And it's not about blaming students. It's also about providing balance. And it's not good for students either. Students are a vital part of our city, and they contribute a lot to it, but they can't afford what's being offered for the most part. And we heard at Planning Committee that these units, these bedrooms, I should say, would be $1,000 a piece. There'll be 40 students minimum here. That's $40,000 coming out of this. That's about profit. Now, I'm not above making a profit. I own a business. But we need a better vision for our city, and this isn't it. Students need safe, affordable housing, and they don't need to be in overpriced apartments in neighborhoods where they're going to have tensions with the permanent residents that are there.
Another key consideration for councillors was the risk of appeal to the Ontario Land Tribunal if the proposal was rejected. Mayor Patterson acknowledged the likelihood that the city would lose such an appeal.
I've never said this before, but I'll just say it. We have a 100% chance of losing at the OLT. Not even like a 95% chance. A 100% chance of losing. And quite frankly, I think the way that that would look, I think is terrible.
Councillor Gary Osteroff, who was against the development, noted the difficult position this potential outcome puts council in.
We're handcuffed. I don't know. I don't think we should be spending the money to fight it. We know we're going to lose it. And so, you know, it's us to deal with the province. So I'm just going to, I don't know. I'm speechless.
Both Mayor Patterson and Councillor Ryan Boehm expressed confusion at the intensity of the opposition, noting that new housing is a top city priority.
I'm a bit stunned, actually, by the discussion around the table tonight. We've put policies in place. We have a development application that meets those policies. And now we would go to the OLT and argue against the very policies that we put in place for the housing. I appreciate where the community is coming from. I don't want to minimize that in any way. Obviously, you know, we're trying to find a compromise, leave some green space there, allow some sustainability for the Lawn Bowling Club to continue. But quite frankly, we've also tried to push towards more integrated neighborhoods and not put all of the student housing, lump it in one area of the city as well. So I'm a bit exasperated, to be honest, by the discussion around the table. But obviously, I would encourage council to be consistent with the direction that we've taken as a council up until now, which is to say housing is a priority. All housing matters.
Let's no longer be the roadblock to getting more housing built. Because if in the end, this does, for whatever reason, end up the specter of the OLT there, we will lose. But all we've done then is increase the costs, spent a bunch more money, and wasted a lot of effort, and delayed the incoming supply of housing units that we so badly need. And to be honest, we're asking for. It's like we're our own worst enemy at times. We ask for something, somebody offers it, and then we go, well, yeah, no, but not really like that. We want something different here. And if we do that for every housing development, somebody needs to explain to me why we even have an official plan.
Ultimately, council voted 7-6 against approving the required official plan and zoning bylaw amendments, halting the development for the time being. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is part 9 of our OUA football season preview, and today we're looking at the Western Mustangs. Western's quest for a fourth consecutive Yates Cup was thwarted by the Laurier Golden Hawks last year, and neither of those games were even close. Western lost by 3 scores in both the regular season game and their playoff rematch, 2 shocking results that sent reverberations through the OUA. This Mustang squad will run it back with a number of key veterans returning, including quarterback Evan Hillock, wide receiver Seth Robertson, defensive back Kojo Odum, and defensive lineman Malcolm Frazier. Though they have some key returners, this team did also lose 6 starting caliber players to the CFL, including wide receiver Mohsen Jamal, defensive tackle Max von Mueldorfer, offensive lineman Eric Anderson, and running back Keanu Yazbek. Look, as long as Greg Marshall mans the helm, the Mustangs will be a top 5 team in the country. There's no doubt about that. They start their season on the road at Richardson August 23rd, and I think Queens will finally be able to overcome the Mustangs and snap their 14-game losing streak. They got close in 2023. I think this year they will break through. Other than that, I think Western will take care of business with some scares against Guelph and Laurier and cruise to a 7-1 record. I think they will slot into the top of the OUA by virtue of a lopsided points for and points against ratio, which is something this team is known for. They'll be the top seed in the OUA, but it won't be as unanimous as it has been in seasons past. That's a wrap for today's sports report. Stop by again on Wednesday for part 10 of this OUA season preview as we take a look at the defending Yates Cup champion, Laurier Golden Hawks. This is Jesse Bell with the Environment Canada Weather Report for the Kingston region. Monday, August 18th, daytime high of 22 degrees and a pretty pleasant sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Low humidity and a medium UV index of 7, perfect late summer day. Tuesday, August 19th, occasional morning rain and drizzle. Otherwise, it's going to be sunny in the afternoon, daytime high of 23, feeling closer to 24. Wednesday, August 20th, breezy in the morning and cloudy throughout the day, daytime high of 21, feeling closer to 20. Thursday, August 21st, it's going to be a beautiful sunny day here in the city of Kingston. Breezy in the morning, a little bit of cloud, but mostly brilliant sunshine. High of 25, that actually feels like 25. Friday, August 22nd, daytime high of 24 with lots of sun in the forecast. Saturday, August 23rd, it's looking like it's going to be a perfect day for the Queen's football home opener against the Western Mustangs. Daytime high of 26, feeling closer to 27. A slight possibility of rain later in the afternoon, but it should be a beautiful summer Saturday. Sunday, August 24th, mostly cloudy with the possibility of a thunderstorm here in the Kingston region. Daytime high of 24, feeling closer to 25. And to kick off next week, Monday, August 25th, daytime high of 22, 70% chance of rain. Otherwise, sunny throughout the day. Public Services and Procurement Canada wishes to advise the public that the LaSalle Causeway will be fully closed to vehicles, cyclists, and pedestrians to allow for the temporary opening of the main marine navigation channel on Sunday, August 24th from 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. Here are this week's relevant road closures. Aberdeen Street, William 2 Johnson is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging. Albert Street, Princess to Mac is closed to accommodate construction activity and staging at 484 Albert Street. Berry Street, Queen to Colborne is closed for construction-related activity at 283 Queen Street. Cataraqui Woods Drive, Rosanna to Holden is closed until August 28th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. each day for roundabout upgrades. Earl Street, Collingwood to Toronto is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Middle Road, Joyceville to Highway 2 is closed until August 22nd from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. each day to complete culvert relining. South Bartlett Street, Smith to Victoria is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. Sydenham Street, Princess to Queen is closed until October 3rd for the Sydenham Street Community Space. Victoria Street, Union to Johnson is closed for sewer separation and road rehabilitation work. Victoria Street, Princess to North Bartlett is closed until August 29th for construction-related activity at 655 Princess Street. And Woodburn Road, Hitchcock to Whitechurch is closed for a contractor to complete culvert relining. Here are some other delays to be aware of. Bay Ridge Drive, Milford to Henderson. Expect delays for the construction of new active transportation infrastructure and intersection upgrades. Catwoods Drive, Centennial to Gardeners. Expect delays for the construction of a new multi-use pathway. Front Road, San Beta Country Club. Expect delays for the installation of sanitary and water main for Utilities Kingston. Traffic will be reduced to one lane in each direction. Gardeners Road at Centennial and Creekford. Expect delays while a contractor completes intersection widening, traffic signal upgrades, and cycling and pedestrian improvements. Highway 2, Abbeydon to St. Lawrence. Expect delays to complete enhanced flood protection of Abbeydon Road, Highway 2, and St. Lawrence Avenue. Highway 15, Kingston Mills to Middle. Expect delays for a contractor to complete work on the Highway 15 CNR overhead construction. John Marks Avenue and Innovation Drive. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to start work on John Marks Avenue, Innovation Drive, and Discovery Avenue. Work includes curb, sidewalk, asphalt milling, and repaving. Lancaster Drive, Limestone to Jasper. Expect delays while a contractor completes construction of a new sidewalk and road improvements. Montreal Street at John Counter. Expect delays for upgrades to the intersection, including new lighting, traffic signals, lanes, paving, and signage to improve safety and efficiency for all road users. And Victoria Street and Earl Street. Expect delays while a contractor mobilizes to site to start work on the second phase of reconstruction of sewer, water main, sidewalks, and road.
Now coming up, we'll have a look at some great community events running in Kingston and the area this week. On Monday, the Kingston Frontenac Public Library has a full day of activities across its branches. At the Central Branch from 9 a.m. to noon, technology tutors are available by appointment for one-on-one tech help.
At the Rideau Heights branch from 10 a.m. to noon, Older Adults Day Out offers special activities with Kingston Community Health Centers. Over at the Sydenham branch, children ages 3 to 5 can climb aboard a school bus for story time from 10:30 to 11 a.m. In the afternoon, the Central branch hosts Bebot Adventures from 2 to 3 p.m. for kids 6 and up, teaching coding with playful robots. That one is waitlist only. At Calvin Park from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m., newcomers can join the English Conversation Circle to practice language in a friendly setting. And wrapping up the day, the Central branch hosts Crafts and Create from 6 to 7:30 p.m., where folks can work on projects, use makerspace tools, and share ideas with fellow makers. On Tuesday, Salsa in the Square runs from 6:30 to 10 p.m. in Springer Market Square. Start with a beginner Latin dance lesson, then join La Vida and friends for line dancing, followed by an open dance floor with salsa, bachata, merengue, and reggaeton, free and open to all ages. On Wednesday, it's Games in the Square from 6 to 8 p.m. Drop by Springer Market Square to play Giant Snakes and Ladders, Connect Four, Chess, Cornhole, and more. Or bring your own favorite game. It's free and family-friendly. On Thursday, Stories in the Square begins at 10:30 a.m. in the City Hall Amphitheater with stories, songs, and fun from the Kingston Frontenac Public Library. If the weather turns bad, it moves indoors to the Central Branch. In the evening, Life Drawing at Art Noise runs from 6 to 8 p.m., giving artists of all skill levels a chance to practice with a live model for just $10. And Stories in the Square presents Inside Out 2 at dusk in Springer Market Square. Bring your own lawn chair and enjoy this free outdoor screening under the stars. On Friday, The Loaf and Ale hosts Music Trivia with Terry from 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. Test your musical knowledge, enjoy a drink, and spend a fun night out with friends. On Saturday, head to Springer Market Square from 11 a.m. to noon for a chef demo by Olivea. Watch a locally inspired dish come together and sample it afterwards for just $2. Then from 1 to 3 p.m., the Adult Hide and Seek fundraiser takes place starting at City Hall. Teams of five compete within set boundaries to raise funds for the Friends of the Kingston Frontenac Public Library. Registration details are available by emailing ygktrivia@gmail.com. And on Sunday, Yoga in the Park runs from 10 to 11 a.m. in Battery Park. It's a free outdoor session led by a local instructor, so bring your own mat and enjoy the waterfront vibes. Later, the Brock Street Street Party runs from noon to 4 p.m., closing the street from King to Wellington. There will be exclusive shopping, a wandering bar, free samples, games, live music, and more. It's free and open to all ages. Have a community event you would like shared on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca. Hey folks, I'm Ellie Sturton, and coming up are your live music events happening around town this week. On Monday, the RCHA hosts Jazz Society Mondays from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. with Inner Harbor Jazz, playing classics inspired by Billie Holiday, Carmen McRae, and Diana Krall. Later, Cuban pianist Danae Alano performs at Hotel Wolf Island from 7 to 9 p.m. with her blend of classical and Afro-Cuban jazz. Cover is just $15 or pay what you can. On Tuesday, the Poulenc Trio performs twice at St. Paul's Presbyterian Church. From 11:15 to noon is a free children's concert, followed by their full set at 3:15 as part of the Waterside Summer Series. Tickets are $45 for adults and $22.50 for youth. That evening, Karaoke for a Cause runs from 7 to 10 p.m. at the Cove Inn, raising funds for Prevent Another Westport Stray with $10 admission. At 7:30, Time Out Bar and Bistro presents Quirks of Human Nature, a free evening of poetry, prose, and music hosted by Meg Freer and Deborah Shermans. And at Hotel Wolf Island from 9 to 10:30 p.m., El Balcon bring Mexican folk fused with global sounds for $20 admission or pay what you can. On Wednesday at Springer Market Square, Swingin' Summer continues from 7 to 8 p.m. with the Dixie Six in a free outdoor jazz concert. At the Broom Factory, fingerstyle guitar master Alexandra Misko performs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Tickets are $35 for early birds or $43 for general admission. On Thursday, the Brownman Electric Trio plays the Cove Inn from 6 to 9 p.m. with a high-energy mix of funk, hip-hop, soul, and jazz for a $10 cover. The Kingston Blues Society Tribute Weekend opens at the RCHA from 7 to 11 p.m. with four back-to-back acts and tickets just over $22. Tiernanogue also features blues from 8 to 11 p.m. with Timothy Campbell, Tony Vanney, and Kenny Paws, and Matt Smith for $10. And Daft Brewing hosts Queerioke from 8 to 11 p.m. for just $5, welcoming the LGBTQ+ community and allies. On Friday, Time Out Bar and Bistro has Scott and Kate playing from 3 to 5:30 p.m., then Wild Card at 6 p.m. The Furball Cruise sails from 6 to 8 p.m. with live music from our band aboard Rockport Boat Lines. Raising funds for the Gananoque District Humane Society, tickets are just $33. At 7 p.m., Kickin' It Country brings Chelsea Road to Springer Market Square with free line dancing starting at 6. The Blues Society continues at the RCHA with Big Mo and the Blues Mission, followed by Angelique Francis. Tickets are just over $33. And at Base 31, Rock the Country opens with I, Mother Earth at 7:30 p.m., with tickets ranging from $65 to $268. Folks can finish the night at Tiernanog with the J Blues Trio and Jeff Dunn from 8 p.m. to midnight for just $10. On Saturday, Tiernanog hosts Sarah Sokol and Sonia Bergen from 10 a.m. to noon, for a $10 admission. At Sydenham and Princess, see Panache A Play for a family-friendly set with puppets from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Saturday sessions at Confederation Park run from noon to 6 p.m. with a free tribute to the Limestone City Blues Festival. Folks can see Night Sun perform at Leopard Frog Farm from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. with tickets for $30. Juniper Cafe hosts summer live music from 4 to 6 p.m. alongside artist Sydney Cox from Heartspire doing live sketching. The Kingston Blues Society Tribute Weekend wraps up at the RCHA with Blue Sill and the Sweet Home Band joined by Chicago Blues Hall of Famer Maurice John Vaughn from 7 to 11 p.m. Tickets are just $39. And Rock the County closes with Big Rec at 7:30 p.m. at Base 31. Tickets range from $65 to $268. And don't miss the Garvin Brothers performing free at Joel Stone Heritage Park at 7:30 p.m. On Sunday, live music Sundays at Finkel Shore Park run from 2 to 5 p.m. with live sets from Mellow Lily, John McClurg, and Frank Ryan. Then at 3 p.m., catch Christopher Jackson, Wayne Riley, and John McClurg in a free show at Time Out Bar and Bistro. Finally, at Hotel Wolf Island from 3:30 to 6 p.m., Deborah Shermans and Jazzy perform evocative piano compositions and dreamy indie pop. Have a local concert that you would like covered on CFRC's website and our news programming? Contact us today via cfrc.ca.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear. CFRC 101.9 FM is pleased to present a new Airwave YGK workshop brought to our community. Young, emerging local musicians are welcome to join us on August 21st at 11 a.m. at CFRC for our free industry intro, Getting Your Music Out There workshop with Mark Garnas and Chancellor Miracle. Come learn about getting your band booked, applying to festivals, procuring booking agents, touring, funding, submitting music to CFRC and other radio stations nationally, plus other great tips and tricks for emerging musicians and bands. Space is limited. Register now through Instagram at CFRC Radio or our website at cfrc.ca. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present the second single from The Winter in Canada's forthcoming untitled album, due out on August 22nd. The new track called Tides is true to the band's sound, with an aggressive downbeat and roaring guitars and bass. You can check them out on all the streaming platforms and pre-order the album, available digitally and on vinyl. For more information, check out thewinterincanada.ca or find them on Bandcamp and Instagram. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete
complete the release rate or submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream Tides by The Winter in Canada on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here with us now on CFRC 101.9 FM. Kingston, watering your garden or washing your car? Take note, summer watering restrictions are now in effect until September 15th. You can use water outside only on designated days based on your address number. Odd-numbered houses water on odd days, even-numbered houses on even days. On your day, use a hose or bucket anytime, but limit sprinkler use to between 5 and 10 a.m. Got a rain barrel? Great, you can use that water anytime, any day. By using water wisely, you're helping protect the local water supply and the environment. Visit utilitieskingston.com to learn more, and let's make every drop count. Queen's Parkinson's Kingston is a student-led club dedicated to raising awareness, fundraising, and supporting those affected by Parkinson's disease in both the Queens and Kingston communities. On September 6th, join Queen's Parkinson's Kingston for the 2025 Parkinson Canada Super Walk, taking place at Lake Ontario Park and running from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Learn more by reaching out to QPK at clubs.queensu.ca and following Queen's Parkinson's Kingston at queens4pd.kingston on Instagram.
No static. No static. No static. No static. Mondays. 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 Monday, 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8. 6 to 8 p.m. 6 to 8 p.m. Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. No Static, Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. CFRC's most varied variety show. CFRC's most varied variety show. CFRC's most varied. CFRC 101.9. CFRC.ca. No Static, Mondays, 6 to 8 p.m.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. This is edition 277, and I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in. On the program this week, I'm going to be sharing a conversation with Damaris Baker, who is an artist and community activist based in Montreal. I got to know Damaris over the last years, mostly through community events and gatherings, that is both cultural events and demonstrations. And in the fall of 2024, when I launched a publication connected to this radio program called Free City Radio, of course, the publication looked at a series of interviews that I did with frontline community organizers and cultural workers in the context of the first pandemic lockdowns, and the publication is called Voices Beyond Lockdown. And I thought it would be interesting to share a few conversations with community members who participated in the event that launched this publication, and think of it as a way to extend the conversation, to continue to think critically about the important social, political, and economic lessons to be learned from the experience of the pandemic lockdowns, to think critically about mainstream narratives on the pandemic that really worked to erase the grassroots organizing that took place. And I think this is important in terms of thinking about social movement history. So it's really a pleasure to have spoken with Damaris, to hear directly reflections on this time from an artist and community activist. So here is our conversation.
There's been a lot of important activist responses to the realities of the pandemic, and the ways that community activists really stepped up to deal with a lot of the intersecting points of crisis at that time. And obviously that carries over into the present. As part of Free City Radio Project, there has been this small publication that came together called Voices Beyond Lockdown, Collective Action and Care Across Borders in a Time of Crisis. This was released in the fall of 2024, and it included the participation of a bunch of cultural workers and community activists. And also folks in Montreal have been engaging with the voices that are highlighted in these interviews through this project. And I thought it would be interesting to pick up those conversations by engaging with some people who took the time to read those interviews and engage with the ideas that are in this publication. So Damaris, you generously came to the launch, and I also know that you're often taking the time to actually read through, whether it's activist books or zines, and you're in a lot of different community spaces. And generously, you agreed to share some reflections sort of in response to this publication. So maybe we could just first start. You brought these beautiful notes with different pen colors, and it looks wonderful. But maybe you could first start by introducing yourself and, yeah, just any sort of initial impressions in response to this project that you felt are important. I guess we could start there. Yeah.
So I'm Damaris, they, them, and I have worked in the past in radio. I'm an animator and a musician, and I've been involved in various different activist movements in other places in the world, in Australia where I've lived and in Canada, just as a community member and as an artist. And I'm really appreciating the different voices that came across in this. You have Martin, who was speaking from the perspective of Indigenous people, speaking about COVID with no hospitals in the northern communities, the importance of the Native Friendship Centre and Resilience Montreal and on the ground communities that support Indigenous people living outside of the reserves, and just taking that perspective, which I was aware of, but then other perspectives, Mohammed speaking from the Guinean community about warehouse workers and just the sort of struggles. He said, I feel really sad that people are forced to go on a hunger strike to call for their rights and health to be respected. So, you know, if you're a mainstream person in Montreal who happens to have a house with room to look after your children, if you happen to have the technology to do things, you're in a very different situation to people who may be living in cramped quarters or working under temporary worker schemes and things. So these voices are particularly important and interesting for people to be aware that COVID impacted on everyone, but it impacts differently, very differently on people. So I spoke about prisoners' rights, dangers of outbreaks in prisons, and just the right of prisoners to not have to live in conditions which are going to be challenging their health, the injustice of that, the fact that often there's no violent crime involved and they're basically there because of a carceral system which is very prejudiced and involves the racism against people of colour, immigrants, and all sorts of justice issues around prisoners' rights to start off with, let alone COVID issues.
I think often on that point, people forget sort of just that basic reality that there's this sort of cycle of economic violence that leads to incarceration. You pointed towards that.
Well, when I remember speaking to people and saying, like, is it 30% of people are actually waiting for their trials? They're basically not in, haven't even been found guilty of anything. They're just particularly in there because they can't pay bail, or in there because they happen to be a community that's been sort of targeted and criminalized. And this issue, like, it comes up here as well, this issue of who is criminalized, why have they been criminalized, what happens when you have been criminalized, and increasingly you're seeing protesters get criminalized, and then you have criminalization of people through not having particular papers or documents, which may be almost impossible to get from a government, even though you're working in the community. But this issue is one of the questions I put down afterwards. Who is criminalised? Who's presented as criminals? And what language does the right use to have us running in fear as they criminalise sections of the community that are resisting their particular agenda? But going a little bit off the track there. Yeah, having Zayed speaking about that, he also said his one of his biggest concerns and fears was that the largest benefactors would be corporations. The Liberal government is trying to bail out big corporations, to simply hand out public funds to corporations. And strangely enough, we saw a huge transfer of wealth during COVID from the people to corporations. And that hasn't really been questioned as to why that was done during COVID and the impact of COVID. I feel that COVID was the beginning of the things that we're seeing now with the far right, the government control, which was necessary, but the actual impact on workers and on immigrants, on incarcerated people, on Indigenous people, has been in many ways extremely negative, and increasingly it's just given more and more power to corporations to be criminalizing and pushing the agenda. And you see what's happening south of the border. Like, COVID was a preparation for that. They were watching very carefully what a government could do and get away with. If you run fear-based politics, you'll die unless we do this. We'll do this, from curfews and shutdowns. I know they were important, but
in terms of health,
just looking at the impact on people, it's interesting to see that COVID has had a huge impact on the way that governments treat its people around the world. So Sundar's talking about the connections with Iraq in countries where you've had a US invasion that impacted the healthcare system, and on top of that, corruption, hospitals not having what they need, and then protests to try and look after people, protests against government. So, you know, what happens globally? You have people in Canada with family all around the world and the global implications of that. So having voices... Brian spoke about the impact of industrialization, Chernobyl, Fukushima, the toxins and pollution, and mining, Canada mining, the impact that has. He's looking very globally about Canada's impact on the world. He also said many people don't understand in Canada why other people are fleeing war and poverty and economic justice, even though our system here depends on it. Mm-hmm. And then Shanice, what does it mean to critique the state, but also realize people need the resources that the state mm-hmm. is holding? So some of these comments, and then Mustafa has so many wonderful comments that I had trouble finding quotes because there were so many good ones. He spoke. I just want to read all of his books. He spoke about pushing. I can't even find. He said. The pandemic illustrates an argument for a policy change. It's underlining the collective needs that are at play. Only through socialized policies can we actually deal with this moment and, by extension, in the long term, save ourselves as a species from environmental disaster. This is crazy to think about, because the unwavering logic claimed by the market is that the market is dynamic. Governments need to give the market space. It's a giant scam, a Ponzi scheme at the highest levels. Like, he talks brilliantly about the very global supply chains, the fact that many economies in the global south, this is quoting him, are dependent on remittances from migrant workers. So you may have a woman who's working as a carer in Canada, sending 70% of her income back to the Philippines or whatever mm-hmm. like that. And what does it mean when you have a COVID situation with the precarity of the work and her working conditions and the difficulty of what's happening, let alone her connection to things around the world? So I felt like these discussions, people sort of want to put COVID behind us because there's a vaccine and there's a vague sense of having a bit more control of things. But the fragility, the points of stress that were highlighted here for the most vulnerable people who are suffering injustices, structural injustices that have been created by the Canadian system, historically the racism, the settler colonial system, the impact on Indigenous people, the neglect, the impact on workers' rights, specifically immigrant workers' rights. If we don't highlight these things now and recognize these voices from COVID, then it's hard for us to push against Polyev's agenda against immigrants if we don't actually look at what's happened and recognize the wisdom and the integrity of the voices of people speaking about their experiences. So, yeah, we all suffered in different ways, but the ways that people suffered who were really in these precarious positions, that, like, the death and the suffering and the absolute stress of how do I care for people around me was and still is huge. And having been able to articulate this in clear ways, I think is crucial to how we organize and work together to resist the wave of far-right politics that's pushing in the world against us.
Respect. And while you were speaking, Damaris, I also remembered, and this is actually not in the zine because it sort of, I think, was articulated a bit over time. And these were interviews that were done really between like March, April, May 2020. But one thing that I think also is maybe like lost in narratives now is the role that activism played, for example, in having mass vaccine access, right? I'm just thinking of that when you were speaking. Like, it wasn't clear at the beginning how that would happen, right? Like, would people have to pay? Also, like, sort of interventions at a global level to ensure distribution, which was not happening at equitably at the beginning. There was a lot of activism around that, right? And then also for governments to be forced to take into consideration, like also like the realities of daily workers, right? Like, for example, the Mexican government was very criticized for like thinking only about the economy in relation to allowing people to circulate at the time when vaccines weren't fully rolled out. But it was this sort of contradictory space, because also the reality is that so many people are daily wage earners, right? And so activists, I think, rightly deepened a lot of policy conversations during the pandemic. And I don't know if there's enough credit given, is what I'm trying to highlight, to the role that like critiques and social movements played in how things transpired at the time. I don't know if that resonates with you at all.
Yeah, I think you know a lot more about this than I do, because you were involved in the activist stuff. But it would be good to actually... It would be really good to highlight the work that activists did, because I know there was a lot of work listening to people and then pushing for it. I mean, there was also a hoarding of vaccines and a refusal to recognise that there was a global push in research, that money was given to Big Pharma to develop vaccines, but then the vaccines were hoarded for the 6 months next vaccine or all sorts of things. But yeah, I mean, workers were speaking out, frontline workers were speaking out about not being given proper the masks and care for them to be able to do resource work. I mean, I have a friend whose father was sick. His mother's a migrant worker who was working in aged care. His father went to hospital, got COVID, brought it home, gave it to the family, then passed away. Wow. And so he was, you know, his mother was working in care. He was working from home, and he was unable to really grieve his father. I think they weren't allowed to invite family to the funeral. Wow. And so people, these stories which just kind of disappeared, and there wasn't really a public grieving or recognition of the suffering and grief that people went through. You weren't even able to publicly grieve things. But recognition of what the activists actually were able to do and achieve in terms of responding to people saying this is what we need to do, and this is what's coming out in these voices as well. There was arguments, you need to deal with prisoners' rights in terms of healthcare, we need to take care of people, we need to really take care of people and recognise people's rights in terms of healthcare and being safe in the workplace. So I think this is part of that, but I wish there was a conversation between the activism that was done then and what's happening now. It feels like people want to close the door on what happened during COVID. Because even you mentioned before, it feels like a little time capsule. Why does it feel like a time capsule? Mm-hmm. COVID is still here. We have a vaccine, but the impacts of what happened during COVID are still being felt. And there should be a conversation between how did COVID change things? I mean, I did a little page here, which was my comment on things that are happening right now. So I had COVID, pandemic, global health crises. That's still there with us now, like fear of other pandemics. How do we care for people? Then you have climate change, but rise of the far-right fascism, rise of corporate power, billionaires controlling trade and governments, AI technology in the service of empire, surveillance, military, social control, the genocide in Gaza and Palestine legitimized by Western powers, the end of international law as we knew it in the past, because it's been so challenged, the ongoing criminalizing of immigrants while wars, genocides, resource neocolonialism creates refugees, and climate change as well, this migration around the world for work and forced migration. Genocides destabilizing in relation to conflict minerals, the Green Revolution. We're talking here about Congo, DR Congo, and then the end of US dominance in terms of a rise of BRICS, sort of in terms of sort of the US dollar and the petrodollar, attacks on workers' rights, the imperial boomerang in terms of military police criminalizing poverty, dissent, Emmy Césaire's idea of what is inflicted onto the colonial countries like Africa, the austerity that was enforced by the IMF on Africa in the 80s and 90s comes back to the US, and there's a stripping of public services and everything, which is exactly what has been done, was forced in using debt, and has been so sort of activists have pushed back against that so much, and it's like, oh, austerity comes to Europe, of course, but North America as well, and then Ukraine, Palestine, DR Congo, Lebanon, Syria, Tigray, Haiti, so areas of huge struggle and conflict around colonial and empire struggles. So this, it feels kind of exhausting to have all this happening, but I think using COVID, of course, using Palestine and various, is so many powerful ways which you can see exactly what the imperial forces are doing, but COVID highlighted a lot of those areas as well. You can learn a lot, like a conversation with COVID and Palestine, actually the struggles and the articulation of what people need and the lies and the complicity of governments in actually sort of trying to gather and solidify control against people. This would be a very interesting conversation to have.
I like how you've done these sort of mind maps, and I'm thinking also about like how community experiences in a city like Montreal, Geogeage, Munyang, you're at a lot of different protests. I've seen you at these different demonstrations, and one thing that comes to my mind is also like, you know, a publication project like this, Voices Beyond Lockdown, is about like hearing a bunch of different people, but you're familiar with this, like when you're at a protest, all the topics that you just mentioned seem, you know, like there's a bunch of different connection points there. But in a protest, you could easily talk about all these things with the people that you're encountering, right? And for me, it sort of like highlights how like a social movement space is so important, right? Like in terms of like learning, in terms of like making those connections and like building an analysis, and also hopefully through that, what counter power looks like.
And this is interesting because I kind of I gathered a thing at the end. Oh yes, which was like a response to that I wanted to sort of say to people, which is yes, it's complicated, but I would say three things. Since the 1600s and before, there's always been resistance to the violence of empire. Yeah. And all of us are complicit and also have resistance in our history. So you can find your history of resistance in your family, connect to it, and start unraveling your internalized white supremacy without getting stuck, like a rabbit in the spotlight. Like, find an area that's meaningful to you in terms of your family and your identity, and refusing this privilege of whiteness that just washes the way the resistance of everyone has resistance in the past. Also, local resistance works and local groups, which, you know, speaking here in your group is a really powerful presentation of different local groups. So I would invite people to join a local group about migrant rights, prisoners' rights, disability justice, just learning and unlearning while you are doing a very simple thing that you can just support a group in one particular way.
Yeah.
And yes, we're all complicit, but you listen to the most impacted and find direction in action together. So just the idea, there are so many groups in Montreal that are doing lovely things, but getting people together to talk to one another about things, getting abolition movements to work with immigrant right movements, criminalization across borders, and working with people on the ground is important, but also having a sense of solidarity between groups can help when you have times where we need to have a sense of gathering and a sense of pushing back together. We can support each other in ways, and I know we often need to work with people who understand things so we can get the work done on the ground, but also having times where we gather together and connect these things in powerful ways, I think it can help to have a solidarity around around areas of resisting the violence, which we're starting to find increasing around the world. The violence, really, the criminalizing of people needs to just be completely pulled apart. The idea you can just say you're a terrorist and therefore you have no, you're just dehumanizing of people for being Palestinian, for speaking about Palestinian rights, the dehumanizing of indigenous people who say there shouldn't be a pipeline running through our land, the dehumanizing to a point where people can be imprisoned, killed. The violence we're seeing now has to really just be, well, who is being criminalized? And we can clearly see who the actual criminals, the serial killers are the people who are stopping the healthcare from coming to people, the people who are actually committing a genocide. So this questioning of the language of terrorism, of criminalization on a really strong level, and solidarity between groups. But I think it's wonderful what the groups are doing, and I'm excited, and I understand people need to get the work done. It's not just talk. It takes energy to get things done, and sometimes you just have to go onto the streets, say to people, what do you need, and then work for housing rights and just do that. Or work with prisoners and say, what solidarity do you need? Sure. How do we work with you and just do the work?
Well, I'm thinking also about like how, for me, and I think you might relate to this, Damaris, there's like a very like artistic aspect to activism, right? Like just in the sense that like making that decision to try to organize something improvised in a sense, like a small protest, right? Like there's so much improvisation and like kind of just on a very like geographical level, like how are we going to deal with the city space? The city's not really intended or planned out necessarily for a protest, right? And then there's like the people are there trying to figure out their chants together, which direction are we going to go, you know? And in the same way, like for me, like these small zine projects, they're not really officialized, right? Like they're just like ways to have a conversation and provoke hopefully other conversations. So in a way, like people often sort of think of art and activism as sort of two spheres, but the energy or sort of like the thinking on your feet improvisation seems for me very connected.
I said to one of my friends, I've been taking in a lot of information about Palestine, and I said to one of my friends, the things that touched me most was the poetry. Because I can receive information which can be quite traumatizing and challenging to receive, but when I read or hear a poem written, suddenly there's this huge there's this feeling of heart and love blooming and people's lives, just this incredible resilience and persistence of humans. And you were saying, like, the protests are theatre. They are like the mushrooms that appear out of the mycorrhizal web of resistance. They are just like, well, here we are, and we're still here, and we have drums, and we kind of have puppets. And you say this does nothing for us. This is just like the mushroom that bursts forth out of the expression of what we're doing. We're going to take to the streets, and you've seen the sort of Palestine every single weekend, one or two protests, along with all of the amazing fundraising, gathering information from the Palestinian Youth Montreal for Palestine, all these other groups. Incredibly strong, lovely, artistic expressions of people gathering together, being physically with other people, and just walking down the streets for a couple of hours. Yeah. We're here every week, 16 months. Every week.
Yeah. Damaris, thank you for this conversation. I really appreciate it.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Stefan. Thank you.
Thanks.
That was a conversation with Damaris Baker, who is an artist and community organizer based in Montreal, reflecting on the Voices Beyond Lockdown zine publication of Free City Radio. It was really a pleasure to speak with Damaris for this project. And this has been another edition of Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and we broadcast weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CJLO 1690 a.m. also in Montreal on Wednesdays at 8 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on Tuesdays at 8 a.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston on Wednesdays at 11:30 a.m. on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria on Saturdays at 7 a.m. On Met Radio, 1280 a.m. in Toronto on Fridays at 5:30 a.m. On CKCU, 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. And on CGSF, 90.1 FM in Vancouver on Thursdays at 4:30 p.m. You can find our archives at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. We are also a podcast. Just look us up, search Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Thanks for tuning in, and I will be back next week.